Lecture 3, The Blazing Star.
In our last lecture, we looked at the first half of the meteoric career of Alexander the Great. And we saw that from the foundations established by his father, Philip II, Alexander initiated a campaign of conquest which would demolish the power of Achaemenid Persia and would establish Greek culture as the elite culture of the entire Near and Middle East. During that lecture, I pointed out that it seemed to me that Alexander was faced with a dilemma: how to be both the Macedonian king and a beneficent and gentle king in the eyes of the Greeks, who he wanted to leave essentially ruling themselves, and how to be the king equal in status to the great king of Persia, a role that in fact he would come now to take on when he defeated Darius III. And I suggested that the turning point for him in his attempt to reconcile these two competing demands probably came as a result of his visit to the oracle of Zeus Amon at Siwa in the Libyan desert west of the Nile Valley and Memphis. And here, I suggested, Alexander found a way to present himself as something that the Greeks would understand as more than just a mortal man, a hero, a character that was godly or semi-divine, if you will, something that he learnt both because that notion was a part of Greek culture, but also because here he was greeted by the priests as the son of Zeus Amon, a title modelled on his now official title as Pharaoh, the son of Amon. So the visit to Siwa certainly gave Alexander an idea of how to present his kingship. It may also have convinced him that he was in fact a god by blurring the division between the human and the divine. But whatever it did to his psyche, and we'll never know exactly what the truth is there, there was still a much more pressing matter, and that was finally defeating Darius III, the great king of Persia. He'd already defeated his forces once at the Battle of the Granicus River, shortly after crossing into Asia Minor in 334, and a year later, just south of the Taurus Mountains, he had defeated Darius himself at the Battle of Issus. But now it was time for Alexander to begin in a serious way, a campaign that would take his forces way away from the Aegean and the Mediterranean, the heartland areas of Greek culture. And so after leaving a Macedonian garrison and a Macedonian governor in control of Egypt, Alexander began marching north back through the modern-day regions of Israel, Lebanon, and Syria before crossing the caravan trails that headed from northern Syria eastwards towards the headwaters of the Tigris and the Euphrates, the region known to the Greeks as Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers. He had left the Mediterranean behind, and he was headed toward the heartland of Persia. Moving into Mesopotamia then, Alexander made his way towards the headwaters of the Tigris River. And here, at the Battle of Gaugamela in 331 BC, he met and destroyed convincingly the army of Darius, who fled the scene of battle and ran away, fleeing to the north and to the east. Some of you may have seen the well-known mosaic depicting this battle, which is now located in the National Museum in Naples. The mosaic shows the very moment at which Alexander is breaking through and Darius in his chariot has turned and is fleeing. People in antiquity recognized that that very moment was a turning point in history, because it marked the beginning of the end for Persia and the final stage of the ascent of Macedon. Alexander was now Lord of Asia, indeed as much as in title. He continued his victorious march eastwards, descending upon Babylon, and here the city surrendered to him, as did the royal capital of Darius at Susa. Now, it's easy to pass over these events as merely further steps in the continual progression of Alexander's inexorable eastern campaign. But what we should stop and recognize is the astonishing degree of wealth that fell into Alexander's lap as a result of this victory. The wealth that Alexander now had at his disposal vastly outweighed anything that any Greek, and probably all of the Greeks combined, had ever known in their history previous to this. Once again, this theme I introduced a lecture or two ago of the massive scale of Hellenism, a whole new scale even now of wealth. Consider this fact, a simple comparison that I think illustrates the point nicely. In 480 BC, when the Athenians defeated the Persians and established their empire, the states of the Aegean sent them tribute. And the Athenian Empire's tribute in 480-479 BC amounted to 460 talents. 460 talents. At Susa alone, Alexander captured 40,000 talents of coined money, as well as uncoined bullion, and even 5,000 talents worth of just purple cloth, the cloth used by kings, because its color is made from tiny sea creatures that are crushed to create purple dye. Massively expensive. 10 times more value just in royal cloth than the entire revenue of the Athenian Empire in the early part of the 5th century. So this gives us an idea of the astonishing scale of the wealth that would now begin to move from the Persian Empire towards the Mediterranean. And this wealth would eventually find its way back to Macedon, to the Hellenistic kingdoms of Seleucus in Syria, into Ptolemaic Egypt, and finally this wealth would make its way even into Rome. This gold and silver can be melted down and reused time and again. But before Alexander had an opportunity to enjoy this newfound wealth, he had to pursue Darius. Though the king had been beaten in battle, he was still alive. And the Achaemenid king, the last ruler of the Achaemenid dynasty, began retreating away from his royal capitals of Susa and Babylon and moving into the upland country, moving into the area beyond Media towards the Caspian Sea, towards the area known in antiquity as Hyrcania, and across into the regions that would correspond in our geography now to northern Iran, right up to the border of modern-day Turkmenistan. However, just as Alexander's army was closing in finally on Darius, the king's own men turned on him, and he was assassinated, cut down by a Persian nobleman named Bessus. This was a terrible anticlimax. The entire movement of Macedon into the Persian Empire, this epoch-making campaign that was going to change history forever, had been framed as a personal rivalry between Alexander, representing the vengeance of the Greeks, and Darius, the sitting Achaemenid king, the descendant of the Darius and the Xerxes who had invaded Greece 150 years earlier. So it was a terrible anticlimax that Alexander did not get the opportunity to defeat Darius in battle, capture and execute him. But, and here we see another example, I think, of the genius of Alexander, he took this disappointment and he refashioned it now, using it as a brilliant opportunity to change the way that he presented his own authority and power. Because instantly, he went from being the force of Greek vengeance over the Persians to refashioning himself as the Lord of Asia and the legitimate successor of Darius, who would now pursue Darius's assassin in order to bring him to justice. And Alexander and his men did this in a forced march, gradually day after day, catching up to Bessus, capturing him, and eventually having him mutilated, sent back to Babylon, and executed, torn in two. Alexander was now the king of Macedon, King Alexander to the Greeks, the lord of Asia, and the heir to the Achaemenid throne. And the question that really we must pay attention to now is, could these things be reconciled? Could he be all things to all men? And my answer to that is, no, he couldn't, though he tried mighty hard. Now, the key event, the seminal event that illustrates the kinds of tensions that Alexander was dealing with here, comes in 324 at Opus, near Babylon, a town where the Macedonian army briefly mutinied against Alexander, and Alexander, in dealing with this mutiny, tried to establish a reconciliation between Greeks and Persians. And the events that surround this mutiny and the banquet of reconciliation, I think, give us a very clear idea of what was going on in Alexander's kingdom and the relations between the various factions and ethnic groups. Let me read you a part of the description that we have. On arriving at Opus, Alexander called together the Macedonians, and he declared that he was discharging from campaign and sending back to their country all those who were unfit for service. He was instantly allowing to leave all of his veterans going back to Macedon. The presents he would give them would make them an object of even greater envy at home and would encourage the other Macedonians to take part in the same dangers. So the old guard, the men who've been campaigning now for about 10 years, are allowed to go home and a fresh group will be brought in. It was not unreasonable, many of the Macedonians, however, were displeased by this and they felt that Alexander despised them. It was not unreasonable for them to take exception to Alexander's words, and they'd had many grievances throughout the expedition. And now what will spill out is a whole litany of the grievances that these men feel about Alexander. There was the recurring annoyance of Alexander's Persian dress. He had now begun to dress like the Persian king. We'll talk about the significance of that in a moment. And they hated the fact that he was training barbarian successors, epigonoi as they were called in Greek, his successors or in his inheritors, Persians who would be trained in the Macedonian style of warfare. And the introduction of foreign cavalry into the squadrons of the companion cavalry. Now, try to imagine for a moment the attitude of Alexander's veterans. These are men who for 10 years have marched way beyond the Greek world, have defeated the Persians in three major battles, and now find that their glorious king is dressing like a Persian, is dismissing the Macedonian veterans, is raising young Persians and teaching the Macedonian styles of warfare, and worst of all, is actually including Persian battalions in the Macedonian army. Now, if any of you are veterans, I'm sure that you'll be able to recognize the kind of ill will that was brewing in Alexander's army as a result of this. Why was he doing this? I think it must be that he was planning for the future, that to rule this entire empire, which stretched from Macedon to India, he would need to have a ruling caste that included more than simply the old Macedonians who'd fought with him. And so his response to this mutiny, his immediate response, was to go into a sulk and to retire for 3 days into his tent. Until after he had worn down his men and his men had come to him and said that they were sorry about this, when they said to him that they simply wanted to be recognized as his kinsmen, then he came out of his tent and he saw his men, these beloved soldiers who'd marched with him. And now look at the moment of reconciliation. And this passage is very, very interesting. Alexander came forward to speak, but his men remained there imploring him. One of them, whose age and command of the cavalry made him a chief officer, spoke as follows. And he says, "Sire, what grieves us, the Macedonians, is that you have already made some Persians your kinsmen. And Persians are called the kinsmen of Alexander and are allowed to kiss you, to come up to him and to kiss him on the cheek, while not one of the Macedonians has been granted this honor." And Alexander, understanding the power of the moment, said, "I make all of you my kinsmen." All of the Macedonians now are ennobled, the equals, if you like, of the king. And at this, Callanes stepped forward and kissed him, and so did everyone else who wished. So there is a great moment of reconciliation between them. Now, what Alexander does then, after making a sacrifice, is to order a great banquet to be held. And the banquet begins with this description. "He and those around him drew wine from the same bowl and poured the same libation, beginning with the Greek seers and the magi, the Persian priests. He prayed for other blessings and for harmony," note this, "harmony and unity in rule between Macedonians and Persians. It is said that there were 9,000 guests at the banquet. Now, what fairly clearly is happening, I think, at the banquet at Opus, is that Alexander is trying to fashion a policy that will reconcile these former enemies so that the kingdom will have a new ruling elite. He's not asking for the unity of all mankind. He's not behaving like some religious leader who simply says, can't we bury our differences and all unite together? No, it is a very specific political gesture. Harmony between Greeks and Persians to create a new ruling elite. And I would support that contention that he's actually trying to engineer a new ruling class by noting that he also forced all of his major officers, 80 of them in total, and thousands of his men, possibly up to as many as 10,000, to take Persian wives. Now, I think that dramatically and graphically illustrates exactly what Alexander was trying to do. Because the simple fact is that those couples would have children who would be bicultural and bilingual, both Greek and Persian. Now, of course, many of his men had already taken Persian wives, or at least concubines, camp followers, and these too he tried to recognize by taking these children who'd been born to the marriage of Greeks and foreigners and by training them now as Macedonian soldiers for the future. Alexander the Great was one of the first leaders in history to practice eugenics. He's trying to manufacture a new ruling caste. The description of the marriage of his men to their Persian wives is a fascinating one. Alexander goes through each of the officers and he tries to find a woman who comes from a corresponding family on the Persian side of equal status, so that he specifically gives to Craterus Amastrina, the daughter of Oxiates, who is the brother of Darius. She is the niece of the great king. And Alexander sat down and charted this very carefully, matching specific women of Persian background to corresponding Greek men. And then as for the Macedonians who'd already married Asian women, we're told, Alexander ordered a list of names to be drawn up. They numbered over 10,000. And Alexander gave them wedding gifts. So what we've got here is a very clear attempt, I think, to create a new ruling class. The integration of Persian soldiers, both those who'd been trained and those who were now brought in as new cavalry battalions, was an attempt to blend the skill of the two groups, and it, of course, recognized the authority of the Persians as equals in empire. Now, this may strike us as merely good sense, but I'd suggest to you that it shows a kind of generosity of spirit and perhaps a view or a look towards the future on the part of Alexander that is dramatically different. The Greeks have thought of the Persians for 150 years as the enemy. And virtually overnight, the Greek who finally conquers those Persians is inviting them to join in rule. Alexander may have recognized the need for this, for bearing the differences, but his men certainly did not. His introduction of the rituals of the Persian court, his wearing of the gowns of the Persian king, simply infuriated his men. And I think that Alexander finally was unable to reconcile the differences in view between the two. Let me try to illustrate this with one specific example that shows you how far apart these two cultures were. In the Persian system, the great king, who was anointed by Ahura Mazda, is the supreme commander of a hierarchically organized society. And throughout that society, every person has a station. When you meet someone of a higher station, if you are a serf and you meet the bailiff, if you are a bailiff and you meet the landowner, if you are a landowner and you meet the regional governor, and so on, all the way up, when you meet that person, you perform an act of obeisance. You prostrate yourself before your superior. Now, Darius is gone, Bessus is executed, Alexander is the great king. What will his Persians do? they must, of course, prostrate themselves in front of him. And Alexander accepts this as the Persian way of recognizing their king. But Alexander then attempted to introduce the same practice at the court for his Greek and Macedonian subjects. In the Macedonian and in the Greek system, you greet a powerful man with a kiss because there is an egalitarian spirit amongst the Greeks and the Macedonians, particularly among the leading Macedonians. Many of these were generals who'd fought with Philip. They were even older than Alexander. To him, he was a successful younger man, but they weren't going to prostrate themselves because in the Greek and the Macedonian view of things, that act of obeisance is what you do before a god. So even at the level of court gesture and ritual, Greeks and Persians speak a different language. And as a result, Alexander, by attempting to introduce this Persian practice, only managed to infuriate the people of his court. I'd like to give you the description here of Alexander's attempt to introduce this practice known as proskinesis, or prostration, because I think it dramatically illustrates the kinds of misgivings that his followers felt. And also, I might add, the way in which he himself was trying to engineer court ritual. There is a story told on the question of obeisance, and it goes as follows. It had been agreed between Alexander and the sophists, the university professors in his retinue, and the most distinguished of the Persians and the Medes at his court, that the subject should be raised during a drinking party. So they've engineered this. They're setting the seeds for this occasion. Anaxarchus launched the topic, saying that Alexander had much better claims to be regarded as a god than Dionysus and Heracles, not so much because of the number and magnitude of his achievements, as because Dionysus was a Theban and not related to the Macedonians, and Heracles was an Argive and was only distantly related. The Macedonians would have better reason to honour their king with divine honours. So Alexander and his inner circle have decided to engineer a conversation at a dinner party to raise the topic of divine honours for Alexander. There was no doubt that once Alexander departed from men, that he would be a god. How much more justifiable it would be, therefore, to honour him now, still while he was present among them as a man. After Anaxarchus had spoken to this effect, those who were privy to the plan praised his words, and they wanted to begin prostrating themselves before Alexander. But the majority of the Macedonians were displeased with this and kept quiet. This is a fascinating incident. We've got an eyewitness here of the Macedonians standing back and thinking, what the hell is going on here? Does this man seriously think that we're going to treat him the way the Persians treat their gods? And so Callisthenes then intervened and said, I declare there is no honour fitting to a man that Alexander does not deserve, but a distinction has been drawn by men, between honours fit for mortals and honours fit for the gods. This is crossing the line from the point of view of many of the Greeks. So Callisthenes then goes forward and he tries to resist this business of Alexander receiving obeisance. And then some of the Persians actually come forward to perform the act of prostration. And the Greeks actually laugh at them. They think that this is comic, the idea of actually performing prostration before Alexander. And so they burst out laughing, and Alexander once again becomes angry over the whole matter. Alexander now engineers an episode so that if the Greeks give him a kiss, they will then perform the obeisance to him. It's his way of saying, look, we're Greeks. Just give me a kiss and we'll carry on as usual. But this way, the Persian subjects will be pleased. Callisthenes apparently went forward to get the kiss and failed to make the obeisance. And so Alexander refused him the kiss, at which he said, then I depart the poorer for a kiss. What these incidents, I think, reveal to us are that Alexander is trying to manipulate every aspect of court ritual in an attempt to fashion himself as someone higher than either the Greeks or the Persians. But all he succeeded in doing was aggravating the Greeks' misgivings about what they called his Orientalism. In fact, after Alexander's death, most of his successors would simply put aside these women. divorce them and ignore these marriages. The epigonoi, these Persians trained as Macedonians, were disbanded, and none of the successors made any attempt to reconcile or to fuse Greeks and Persians. They simply imposed Hellenism, Greek culture, on their subject areas. So the dream of a kind of fusion between the two cultures really dies with Alexander. And that may be unfortunate or it may be inevitable, it's hard to say. Even after his conquest of Darius, though, Alexander's campaigns continued. We resume the story as he pushes his Macedonian army even further east. Now, what is left to gain, one has to ask here. The great king is dead, Alexander has taken over, he's won all of the great capitals of the Persian kings, Babylon, Susa, Persepolis and so forth, and yet Alexander keeps campaigning, driving his army further and further east. He takes them into the mountain passes of the Hindu Kush, he takes them up into Pakistan, he tries to attack a mountain ridge 7,000 feet above the Indus River, the area known to the Greeks as Aornos, and the principal reason that he does it, according to our ancient sources, is that Heracles had failed to do it. Now, I've tried to resist psychoanalyzing Alexander up until this point, but it does seem to me that in the final phase of his campaign, after he has won all that he can legitimately expect to win in conquering the Persians, we have to entertain the idea that Alexander has really taken on the notion seriously that he is a god, and that he will now perform accomplishments and deeds that not only no man has ever accomplished before, but not even a god has accomplished. So he keeps marching right into the Hindu Kush, and then he comes back down towards the Indus, and there he overtakes and conquers most of the local governors, men such as Taxiles, and he even conquers the most powerful king of northwest India at the time, the king known as Porus. And frankly, he would have kept on going even further, across northern India, probably across Tibet and even into China, but for the fact that his army had had enough. Now, the popular story told of Alexander that he wept because there were no more empires to conquer is actually nonsense. Alexander didn't weep. He knew there were more empires to conquer, and he wanted to go after them. But now I think we are really talking about a man driven by a kind of madness. To the Greeks, it was a pathos, as they called it, a yearning, a desire to go ever further beyond every pass and every mountain into every new territory. But his army wouldn't go any further. They'd had enough. They'd had enough of seeing him become more like the Persian king they'd conquered. They'd had enough of seeing Persians brought into their army. They'd had enough of the training of young Persians. They'd had enough of prostration. And most of all, they'd had enough of marching east. Because by now, they'd been on the road for 11 years, had conquered the empire, and simply wanted to return and to enjoy the fruits of their victory. It is in the return from India that I think we really see the best evidence for what, frankly, we can call Alexander's megalomania. He had a fleet built, which was commanded by his general Nearchus, and which sailed along the northern coast of the Persian Gulf. How easy it would have been to have transported his army back that way, and to bring them quickly and safe and sound back to Babylon. But instead, he marched his army through the harshest desert regions he ever crossed at any time in his campaigns, at a time when there were no more enemies to conquer except isolated towns in the southern Iranian desert, the area known as Gedrosia in antiquity. It really looks to me as if a spoilt man who has been cheated out of his chance of further eastern conquest by his army is now, in fact, punishing them by marching them through the desert so that there are men going mad with thirst and even dying. And his disastrous return from the east then is only finally capped off by his own death of a fever in Babylon in 323 BC. A pathetic end, frankly, to what had been a great military career. But on the other hand, perhaps it's better that it did end at that point, because though Alexander was a great general, we have little evidence that he was a great commander, a king of a region. His policy of administration was essentially a duplication of the Persian system. And often, he simply left the same men in charge of a region that he'd conquered who'd been there before him. He may have wanted to even go further west and take on the Carthaginians. We'll never know because he died before any of these plans could be put into operation. But I think the final lesson from Alexander is that for a great general such as him, it was much easier to wage war than it was to rule a kingdom.